October 25th, December 25th, 2019, at the VIHE in Vrindavan, and we're going to be studying Canto 6, Chapter 18, Text 37 to 55. So I think we're going to do the same kind of thing we did yesterday because I was really happy with how that worked out. So let's jump right away to text 41. I'm going to like do this and kind of get it out of the way. So in the final paragraph of Prabhupada's purport, if we can just, let's read this all together. Sometimes our Krishna consciousness movement is criticized for mingling men and women, but Krishna consciousness is meant for anyone. Whether one is a man or woman does not matter. Lord Krishna personally says, Striyo Vaishas Tata Sudras Te Piyam Cha Paramgatim. Whether one is a woman, Shudra or Vaishya, not to speak of being a Brahmin or a Kshatriya, everyone is fit to return home back to Godhead if he strictly follows the instructions of the spiritual master and Shastra. We therefore request all the members of the Krishna consciousness movement, both men and women, not to be attracted by bodily features, but only to be attracted by Krishna. Then everything will be all right, otherwise there is danger. So, take a couple minutes and just write down for yourself just a few sentences, two or three sentences, on why this instruction is important. Just the last part. All right. Well, this is 18:41, right? What's this verse again? Number
6:18:41.
Okay. So you've all written a few sentences, two or three sentences, about why this paragraph is important. And I want to ask everybody, I'm going to go around, I'm going to ask everybody, if 95% of the members of ISKCON were to have this paragraph as the guiding principle for the dealings between men and women in ISKCON, what would happen? Be specific, please. What specific things would happen? I don't want some general fluff. I want something specific. And I'm going to go around the room and I'm going to ask everybody. Yes, we'll start with you.
No restrictions for women.
No restrictions for women. What kind of restrictions?
To teach, for example.
What?
To teach.
Okay, no service restrictions for women.
Yes.
I'm sure there'd be some restrictions. In other words, we'll probably still have a men's bathroom and a women's bathroom in this country. That's going away in a lot of the world, by the way. Okay? Yes, what do you say? What would happen if 95% of the devotees in this kind followed that code?
They would follow?
If 95% of the members of this kind followed this paragraph, what specific things would happen in this kind?
Last paragraph after reading, what I understood, men and women, if they are doing everything for Krishna, so they are really right. Otherwise, if they will get attracted.
So, if they were actually doing, if 95% of the devotees in ISKCON were actually doing this, what behavior?
So not everyone is.
I want you to pretend. If 95% of the devotees in ISKCON were living by this paragraph, what kinds of things would happen in ISKCON? Can you give me one?
Then we can we will be benefited, all of us will be benefited, and our generation will get a good example of good culture.
Could you be more specific? What kind of specific things would happen in ISKCON if 95% of people were living by this? I'll come back to you in a minute.
There will be no fights.
No fights? About anything?
If if they are not in the bodily platform, so they will all think we are servant of Krishna. So we should not be fighting.
There will be no fight. Just this morning, I heard Prabhupada say that if we fight among ourselves, our movement will be ruined and become impure. Yes?
So I thought that the cooperation in the services would function more smoothly.
Okay.
Deep understanding of mere souls.
What specific thing? What specific change would you see, Miss Anna? What specific?
Respect. Full respect.
I need you to be more specific. We'll come back to you. Yes?
We have more decent children.
Can you think of something specific? Okay, we'll come back to you. Yes?
Everyone is entitled to go back home.
What would you see in ISKCON? What would you be able to see and hear in ISKCON? We'll come back to you.
Support system will be well established for each other. So they don't just cut off the other person just because they're packaged to the other.
Could you be a little bit more specific? We'll come back to you. Yes?
More people from outside will join this movement.
I think that is definitely would be true. Did you think of a specific thing? So we're there.
Well, the divorce rate will go down.
It would become very small.
Yeah. There will be more drama
choices. I'll stop it. That's what I was going
to say. He stole yours! I'll see if you can think of another one.
It's going to be seen as the perfect society, the role of the society.
Vision of natural system will be well established because women are respected and at the same time they are given the services.
We have, yes, you choose. Anything else I said I didn't mention? No, I want everyone to come with something. Yes?
No men will make gardens.
No men?
No men make gardens. I'd be happy to do it.
We make gardens happily.
I said it's not good.
Have you thought of something?
The deep understanding of yes? We are souls.
No, I want you to think of something. Can you think of something? What would you see in this kind? Did you think of something else?
We have a static kitan.
Yes.
So there will be competition between the matapis and
the matapis. No women right activists within this one.
There wouldn't be any need for it. And no anti-women activists.
Strong spiritual advanced atmosphere.
This is what I was waiting for somebody.
Yeah. There will be no punishment advice because everyone is attracted to Krishna, not
thank
to
you.
Sex.
Thank you. That was what I wanted.
do we spend talking about, writing about, discussing, the relationship between men and women and household women? And now, we have to. I'm not saying we shouldn't. We have to. But oh my God, you get tired of it? I'm like, I joined the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. I didn't join the International Society for Men, Women, Consciousness. Oh, I came. There's plenty of men, women, consciousness out in the world. If I want men, women, consciousness, I'll leave ISKCON. And that's all over the world. Sorry if I'm a little upset about this, but I'm not sorry. I'm sorry I say sorry, not sorry. I'm so tired. I'm tired of it. I'm really, I've been in this movement since 1973. Will we stop talking about men and women and talk about Krishna, please? At least, you know, 85% of the time, I don't mind if, you know, we have to talk, it's there in the Bhagavatam. It's not like it's not there. We're going to hit these verses now, today. It's not like it's not there. It's there. We have to talk about it. But we're supposed to be interested in transcendence. Ermula's frustration.
Isn't it part of transcending, right?
Yes, but our focus should be on becoming attached to Krishna.
Yeah.
That should be our focus. And, you know, it's like these other things, that they need to be done. They're important. It's not that they don't need to be done. It's like, you know, we all got to take a bath and we all have to use a toilet and we all have to brush our teeth. But if we're spending all of our time talking about the toilet and the shower, it's kind of like, can we move on now? Prabhupada talked about that. He said, we're having a meeting in this room and there's also a toilet room, he said, but we're not concerned with the toilet room. So obviously you have to keep the toilet room clean and it has to be functional. And the other night in the place where I stay, the drain in the shower backed up and my bathroom flooded. It was going to flood the whole house. I had to have a plumber come at 8 o'clock at night. So, you know, sometimes you got to take care of these things. But that shouldn't be the main issue, right? And it should be that after chanting Hare Krishna for a while and taking prasadam and so forth and so on, that to be attracted by Krishna. And I think many times in ISKCON we're afraid to be attracted by Krishna. You know, we're actually afraid of it. And I can't remember what temple I was in. I have a hard time remembering my geographical location. I leave that to Google Timeline. But I can't remember what temple I was in. I was greeting the deities and I was standing up at the altar. There was some lady standing next to me. I don't remember who she was. And I said, isn't Krishna handsome? And she said, are we allowed to think that Krishna is handsome? I said, who do you want to think is handsome? Some guy? You know, just like... Hare Krishna. So if we could do this, I mean, like we said here, there would be a very small divorce rate. All over the world, I've asked devotees, if just all over the world, devotees, non-devotees, everyone, if all married couples all over the world, if the husband and wife treated each other with respect, like we had here, the ideal, right, the Maya family and the ideal family we looked at yesterday. If just that change happened in the world, let's say nothing else changed in the world, but we woke up tomorrow morning and every husband and wife treated each other with love and respect, would that one change make a big difference in the whole world? It would be tremendous. I mean, it would just be this huge, huge, huge thing. And honestly, that can only happen when people have a mood of being a servant of God. Not as a religion, you know, not as a kind of faith, not as a belief, but really, if people really have a mood of falling in love with God, that's the only way, you know, that it can actually happen. And the fact that, I mean, the fact that in our ISKCON movement, we certainly haven't achieved, you know, 98% of this, it attests to that what's lacking is to focus on our attachment to Krishna. I mean, that's right. You all made those lovely flow charts about how to become equipoised, and it comes down to really being a deep devotee, not a superficial devotee, not a, you know, this is my religion devotee, but really a deep devotee and really falling in love with Krishna. I mean, that's, you know, we talked about the other day Bhagavad Dharma, and we were defining what is religion and talking about how Prabhupada said that real religion is to know God and to love Him. And that, you know, my dear friends, those of you listening here, those of you listening on a recording years from now in faraway places, if we don't become attached to Krishna, what are we doing? There's a nice statement, you know, in the Shastra that if people take up spiritual life and they're still filled with the same fears and attachment as everybody else, what is the point? What is the point? You know, if we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're seeing the beautiful, beautiful Krishna Balaram, Radhasham, Lalita, Vishaka, Gorni Tai, so attractive, and we're still caught up in some, you know, skin and hair and fat and, I mean, really? Sorry, this is what happens when you have a vanaprastha to give to class, and I make no apologies for it. So, this is, it just doesn't make any sense. Remember one of my godbrothers once was talking about how doctors and nurses, you know, they're cutting up a body, they're in the surgery room cutting up a body, and they're flirting with each other in the surgery room. It's not enough. I thought it was so profound. It's not enough to see that every ingredient of this body is actually disgusting. You know, I was once in an airport waiting with a whole bunch of devotees, and there was, you know, in airports they have television screens because nobody in modern society can go for a couple hours without a television screen. So they had these television screens, and there was an advertisement for some hair product, and there was this young, attractive woman with this unbelievable hair, like just, you know, I don't know how many times in my life I've seen a real human with hair like that. I'm sure there's a few on the planet, probably 1,000 out of the 7 billion people. But anyway, so just incredible, thick, glossy hair, you know. And she was twirling her head so her hair was spinning around. And all of the men who were with the group, I don't know, 20, 25 minutes, all the men who were with the group immediately looked at the floor. And I was thinking, you know, if she cut off her hair and it was lying on the ground, who would be attracted? If we see hair on the floor, right? We see sometimes hair on the floor. Does anybody find it attractive? Does anybody go to a barber shop and sweep up the hair? What we find attractive is life. What was attractive really wasn't the hair. Hair isn't attractive. It's actually disgusting. What we're attracted to is life. And one reason we're attracted to youth is that youth is full of life and vivaciousness. That's what we're attracted to. So ultimately we're attracted to Krishna, who's the life of all that lives, the soul of the soul. Navayovanamcha, the eternal youth. So, you know, we should at least be progressing in that direction. And should be what's in. And Prabhupada, you know, if it's like that, then Prabhupada says, then everything will be all right. Then everything will be all right. Then there isn't a problem. But that is what we should be helping each other to do. And I find it very sad that many times the way we try to find solutions to these problems is just by manipulating things socially or trying to manipulate the rules and this kind of thing. And that's okay. It's not that that's not important. But it's not the essence of the thing. It's not the core of what's going to change. You know, if you eat too much, it will help not to keep cake in your refrigerator. But that alone is not going to solve the problem. Yeah? Does that make sense to everybody? We're making some structural change. That's useful, but... So anyway, this is a very, very important report. And it's especially important, I wanted to start with this for practical sake, but also wanted to start with this as really the overriding theme in this section, because this is the kind of section that a woman preacher doesn't really want to preach about. This is the kind of section that somebody like me goes, oh my God, do I really have to talk about these verses? So this is a section of the Shastra that's really like pounding women. You know, really, really, really pounding women. And we don't find much of the Shastra that's really pounding men as a gender. We find a lot of the Shastra pounding on conditioned living entities without so much regard for gender. Just like, if you're in Maya, if you're a conditioned soul, you're in Maya, you have this problem, this problem, this problem, this problem. But we do find a lot of pounding on women as a group, as a gendered group. And of course, the reason for that is that most of the Bhagavatam is spoken by men to men. The sections of the Bhagavatam that are spoken by women do pound on men as a gender. And the section of the Bhagavatam spoken by men to women also do that. So whenever that situation is there, you will find that the nature of the male ego is also pounded. But generally we don't find that. There's an overriding emphasis on the conditioned female ego as being just really awful. But I hate to break it to you guys, the conditioned male ego is equally awful. It's just a different flavor of awful. You know, that's all. It's just, we're going to talk about monkey stool or pig stool, or, you know, it's all disgusting stool. And basically the false ego is disgusting. So it's not that conditioned souls and women's bodies are particularly disgusting and conditioned souls and men's bodies are particularly not disgusting. Anyone who's opposed to the personality of Godhead is disgusting and is duplicitous and is selfish. And it just shows up a little differently. And one of the main reasons it shows up a little differently is because of the power differential between men and women. So I think, notwithstanding a lot of propaganda in modern society to portray women as powerful warriors equal with men, there's more and more propaganda like that to try to portray women physically as having power equal to men, which makes no sense whatsoever from a medical, biological viewpoint. But the reality is not like that. The reality is that women's bodies are weaker, and there is a power differential. And women are, just like we see here with Diti, that she's dependent on her husband to get what she wants. She's not able to get what she wants directly. And because of that, the selfish conditioned ego of someone in the female body manifests differently because of this power differential. So she's manifesting this by trying to convince her husband to give her what she wants, which it wouldn't be working so much the other way. But the men certainly manipulate women for their own purposes. Am I correct? Men manipulate women for their own purposes just as much as women manipulate men for their own purposes. It's not this manipulating others, being deceitful, being duplicitous, and manipulating somebody for your own selfish purposes while you're appearing to be their friend and appearing to care about them is certainly not limited to the female gender. Am I correct about this? Or are all men just simply selfless, upfront? No. Now, particularly why we would talk about women is that women have a reputation, and a well-deserved reputation on some level, as it's stated here, for being saintly. So generally, women are trusted more than men, although Prabhupada quotes Janaka Pandit as saying, don't trust women. But generally in the world, women are trusted more than men. That's quite obvious everywhere. And there are far fewer criminals that are female than that are male. When women commit crimes, people are much more astonished. If a woman kills her own children, she's usually considered to be mentally ill. That's not generally the case if a man kills his own children, for example. So women are generally considered to be of a higher caliber. And I think that this is one reason why Kasyap is speaking like this. He's saying women are generally considered to be trustworthy and of a higher caliber than men. But actually, it's not the case that they're selfish and devious and duplicitous. By the way, we do see in society that women are the civilizing force of society. So, Prabhupada talks about how the male form is particularly, not, I don't think here, but how the male form is particularly suited to transcendence. That's especially true if you look at Ashtanga Yoga. The disciplines of Ashtanga Yoga are much more geared to a male form than a female form, which I don't want to get into today. But the male body and the male psychology, the male mind, the male brain is much better able to focus on one point. The female brain is much better suited to multitasking, which is very useful if you have six kids and you're cooking. So as far as particularly Ashtanga Yoga, the male body is definitely superior overall, although there are women Ashtanga Yogis. But the women particularly, as Prabhupada says, there are always more women at religious functions, except in ISKCON. Especially ISKCON, India, where you'll see 300 men at Mangalartik in many temples and 10 women, which is due to a concerted, deliberate preaching strategy. But Prabhupada mentions that in every religion, women outnumber the men. That's a sociological fact. Again, except in ISKCON, that is not true. It's true in ISKCON China, and it's true in ISKCON Russia, but it's not true in the rest of the ISKCON world, where the men greatly outnumber the women. But it's a sociological fact that women outnumber men as far as being religious. And Prabhupada also talks about how married men are more trusted than single men. Now today, in modern society, you cannot discriminate in hiring men and say, we'll only hire you if you're married. What Prabhupada said when he was a young man, that employers would not hire a single man. So there's a tremendous amount of sociological research, and it's just a statistic that the vast majority of criminal activities are performed by what kind of men? Not only men, but men who are single and young single men. So the vast majority of crimes, the most dangerous drivers, the vast majority of criminals, the vast majority of people that are just basically causing trouble in society are young unmarried men. And again, this is just, you can look it up. These are just sociological statistics. That when a man is married, girlfriend doesn't do it, by the way. So it's not just a woman. A girlfriend does not have this effect. But a wife civilizes a man. That men who are married, they're more honest, they're more responsible, they work harder, they contribute more to charity. Men who have daughters contribute more to charity than men who have no children or men who have only sons. So again, these are just statistics, that women seem to be the harbinger of the repository of ordinary religion. I'm not talking about transcendence, but ordinary religion and culture in society. And if you think about that biologically, it makes a lot of sense, because women have babies, so, and women are very vulnerable physically. A pregnant woman, a laboring woman, a breastfeeding woman is physically vulnerable, and therefore women want to have the father of their children to be a responsible, stable person. Without that, life is very difficult. So whereas the men don't particularly care, they're happy to impregnate a woman and walk away. It doesn't really matter to them so much. So the women have a very strong vested biological interest in having men be cultured and responsible. I think it's something very hardwired into the female psychology. So you do have that dynamic going on, that the married women stabilize the whole society. So have this difference in the world.
All right.
Can we say specifically what are, because we're going to look at the problems with female ego, what are the specific problems with the male ego that's not so much there in the female ego?
Can you repeat again, please?
What are the problems with the male false ego that are not so much there in the female ego?
Right.
They're both problems, different kind of problems.
Aggression.
Some years ago, I read an article about one of these transgender people, some woman who was transiting to become a man and getting testosterone injections. And she said that all of a sudden this person found themselves fighting a lot. So aggression. What else?
Well, I mean, in the previous session here, when we spoke about this topic, it was said that women's lust is more kind of spread over.
Yes.
And man's lust is more focused.
That's
more,
right.
Maybe more gross.
Yes.
Physical.
Yes. Men's lust tends to be extremely physical and extremely focused. Which, and women's lust tends to be very diffuse. Which is one reason why often women don't understand their own lust. And that has a positive and a negative for men. It has a positive for men in that their maya is much more obvious. It's a lot easier to deal with something that's more obvious. But it also makes it much harder to deal with. Definitely men struggle much more with physical lust than women do. That's definitely a fact. Individuals, there are always individuals who are exceptions, but as a class, men struggle much more with physical lust than women do. But it is easier for them to see it for what it is. For women, often they can't see it for what it is. I run into this all the time with devotee women who will say, I'm not interested in this kind of thing, I don't have any desire for this kind of thing, and then you see them a month later and you're like, what happened to you? And it happens all the time. Just talking to a good friend of mine last night who's in this very situation, you know, she divorced her husband in, I don't know how many years, 30 years, because he wasn't so much into Krishna consciousness, and she's just going to dedicate her life to Krishna and just going to be austere. And she's with, what, man number 5? And it's like, where was the no lust? So, and she'll say, oh, I'm not in this for the lust. And I'm like, okay, that's interesting. So I see this all the time with women, and I don't hear this much from men. The men are usually just very upfront. You know, I can't handle this. I need to get married and I just can't deal with this anymore. Whereas the one to say, no, it's all spiritual. And you're like, whatever. So it's you know. Any other peculiarities of the male falsity?
Yes, yesterday text chapter 17, text 30 explained that men are more intelligent.
But the men are more intelligent. What kind of intelligence?
I saw in text 30.
What kind of intelligence? Krishna identifies a certain kind of intelligence with women in the Bhagavad Gita. He uses the word mega. And the intelligence generally connected with men is called buddhi. And the intelligence connected with women is called mega. So both men and women have intelligence. And there's certainly very many intelligent women. In fact, the person with the highest IQ ever recorded is female. So there are certainly intelligent women, but it's a different type of intelligence. But the male ego definitely has the mood of, I'm more intelligent. part of the animal. More aggression, more aggression, and more intelligence, much more focused, physical lust, anything else?
They want to be like more respected?
Yes, much more interested in status. It's not that women aren't interested in status, and it's not that men aren't interested in connection, but again, this is really solid stuff. And again, there are individuals. There are some very status-conscious women, and there are some men that just don't care about status at all. But on the whole, men are much more interested in status. There's research about conversation styles, that the first thing that what men are filtering for when they have a conversation with someone else is, what's our status? Who's higher, who's lower, who's equal? That's the first thing they look for. And then they look for connection. Women first look for connection, then look for status. Women get status through connection, and men get through connection through status. So the filter is a little different. It's also about aggression. It's quite interesting. You see this among the animals as well, that when males meet somebody else for the first time, they figure out who's higher and who's lower, and then they can establish a friendship. And women don't do that. They establish friendships and then decide who's higher and who's lower. It's a different way of going about it. I really noticed this at one GBC meeting. And I attended some GBC meetings, and I always feel like I was parachuted into the middle of an American football field. And I remember one meeting where I attended, so there was a break when we were having prasadam, people were kind of milling around, and two different men came up to me and directly insulted me. Directly. And I understood that they were playing a male game of who's higher. They were fighting. They were picking a fight with me. But I freaked out. I was like, oh my God. I couldn't handle it at all. It just was so contrary to the way my psychology works. But I can understand, these are guys. They're jockeying for position, and they're jockeying for status. They're seeing who's higher than the other. I couldn't relate to it at all. I thought, I don't belong here. And then I just said nothing. This is not my place. It's not my environment. You know, I felt like I couldn't breathe in it. Okay. So, starting at the beginning here. So, first thing is that she says that she wants a son who's going to kill Indra. And Kasyapa's attitude is that of forgiveness towards his wife. And the reason, what's important to understand, is that the reason that Kasyapa is criticizing her nature is that he doesn't want to blame her. That you can't blame someone for acting like who they are. It's like if children are messy and noisy, well, that's what they do. Children are messy and noisy. And you can't get angry at children for being messy and noisy. So he's saying you can't get angry at a woman for using the men in her life for her own purposes and pretending to be loving when she's not. It's just the way that the women's psychology is. And so now he's saying, well, boy, now I'm in trouble because I told her she could have whatever she wanted, and now I'm going to be responsible. And he says, I've become attached and I'm a wretched person. He said, I should have acted as the man. And here we have, again, this idea that Prabhupada talks about that we did yesterday, so I'm not going to get into it again, but whether the relationship in marriage is a material one or a spiritual one. And it's particularly important because of the difference in male-female psychology that the man be the leader, if at all possible. If at all possible. I mean, if you have an unqualified man, what can you do? If it's possible in the marriage for the man to really act like a man. And what we find in the Bhagavatam is a lot of these problems was when the women controlled the man instead of the man actually using that intelligence. There's no good jumping up and down about having superior intelligence if you don't use it. So he should have used it. He should have used it earlier and thought, like Prabhupada says, too much devotion is a sign of a thief. He should have used that intelligence and said, how come my wife has all of a sudden become so nice to me? You know, 10 times nicer than she was before. She probably wants something. And I should be a little careful. And I should be a little careful about giving carte blanche benedictions. All right, so here, Prabhupada talked, you know, Kasyapa is talking about how a woman's beauty hides her duplicitous intentions. And Prabhupada talks about women, especially at 16, 17. So that's, and there's one conversation where Prabhupada said that even an ugly woman can find a husband when she's 16. Yeah, and then she loses her chance. At least she has a youth on her side. And, you know, of course, sometimes men use their physical attractiveness to hide their deceit, but I think men more often use their money and status and power to hide their deceit. So again, it's a little different way of the false ego. So the women use their bodily beauty, their sweet voice, oh, you're a hero. You know, they use that. And the men use the, oh, I have a Jaguar, and I have a BMW, and I'm the president of the company, and I have, you know, $100,000 in the bank. I remember reading about this one guy who said that the way that he was able to convince women to have illicit relationships with him is when he would take them on dates, he would take them to furniture stores. So he'd take his date to a furniture store, and she would think, oh, he wants to get me a house with furniture. And then she'd have a sexual relationship with him. So, you know, there's different ways of convincing people to try to get people to do what you want. But women particularly do that with their physical attraction. I don't know if I should say this or not, because it's very embarrassing. But it was when I was 53 that all of a sudden I realized that I simply wasn't attractive anymore. It was kind of shocking to look in the mirror and see that my youth was gone. And I had to think about why it bothered me, why I didn't like the fact that I wasn't youthful anymore in my appearance. I mean, people still tell me I look good, but I'm like, no. Just look at an old picture of me, you can't even tell it's the same person. And I realized that women use their physical attractiveness to control others. This is very embarrassing to say, but I'm just going to put it out there. Like Lord Shiva, who said that he was also attached, following his footsteps. So I can see that women use their physical attractiveness to make men lusty and to make women envious. And by doing that, you can control them. Basically, if you make men lusty, then they'll want to please you because they'll think, oh, maybe you'll give me something that I want. You know, even if you haven't the slightest intention of giving them anything at all. But simply flashing your attractiveness will get the men to do what you want. And women, when they become envious, they'll also think, well, maybe if I attach myself to you as an attractive woman, some of that will rub off on me, and I'll also be able to get something through your attractiveness. And when I saw that that was the basis of women being attached to their appearance, I immediately became disgusted. And I said, you know, this is not something, I'm very happy to give this up. I was actually just telling my daughter the other day, my mother, even at the age of 75, looked like she was 40. I have very young genes in my family. So when I was 30, I looked literally like I was 13 years old. And I said to my daughter, Krishna actually blessed me with looking old earlier because I'm a preacher, and it's actually very inconvenient. It's not a good thing for a lady preacher to look young and attractive. It's a problem. So I took it as a great blessing. But that's, you know, and men do that with their, women do that with their physical appearance, and men do that with their status and their power and their money, the same thing. They use it to make women lusty and to make other men envious as a way of controlling them. So we should be extremely careful. You know, Prabhupada said, otherwise there is danger. If we become attracted on this basis to each other, if we become attracted on the basis of the body or status or money or something like that. Of course, in the Hare Krishna movement, we do it by how devoted I am. You know, I remember seeing this one, verse 12, sannyasi, in the kirtan, he's playing the mridanga, and he kept looking at the lady's side while he was playing the mridanga. And I think a week later, he wasn't a sannyasi. But I remember looking at that and just going, oh my God, really, seriously. So, you know, we also do that thing, just you know, we're worshiping Krishna with the idea of attracting people. So he's saying, I became bewildered by this. I became bewildered. Of course, if we're attracted to Krishna, we're not going to become bewildered by this, because he's the most beautiful, and he's the most rich, and he's the most powerful. And we'll become attracted to him. Instead of thinking, this other person who's full of this opulence will be able to give me something that I want. So sorry to break it to all of you, but ain't no other jiva going to be able to give you what you want. So here, Kasyapa says, and Prabhupada talks about this also, how that women can even kill their male relatives for what they want, and of course, men will also kill their female relatives for what they want. 55% of all murders happen in the family, whether it's men killing the women or women killing the men. So this concept of killing the people that you love, or that you ostensibly love for some higher purpose. And Prabhupada uses this purport to talk about that women shouldn't be independent. And he says, women should be cared for so that they will not be free to manifest their natural tendency for gross selfishness. And this is not a very popular statement by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, 42. And nobody minds the idea that women should be protected on a physical level, because, again, I hate to break it to modern society, but men are physically stronger than women. Just sorry to give this newsflash. But it's not so much that women have to be protected from men. You know, nobody's going to argue with that. Even the biggest feminists say that there have to be special laws to protect women. There's just no way you can get away from that. And by the way, if women do become very muscular, they lose their fertility. So there's some, at least temporarily, so there is some relationship. But that's not why Prabhupada's saying women need protection. He's saying that women need protection from their own selfishness. Now, of course, there's some implication here that the men are less selfish than the women. There is an implication here that men don't need that same kind of protection. However, in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, it's stated that the wife acts like a fort to protect the husband. So again, this is a very mutual kind of protection. As we were saying, statistically speaking, married men are far less likely to be criminal or irresponsible. The main social problem in society is young unmarried men. And so there's a certain protection that women give men, and there's a certain protection that men give women. And therefore, in a civilized society, the vast number of people should be
married
when they are
young.
This is also not a very popular stance. What?
You have to give up your enjoyment, independent enjoyment.
Yeah, marriage is a responsible way to enjoy the world. And it civilizes both the man and the woman. It civilizes the man. You know, if people want to stay brahmachari because they want to be irresponsible, that's not right. And you hear that. Krishna talks about that kind of renunciation. You're renounced just because it's troublesome. So, yeah, marriage forces responsibility. Just being married, what to speak of having children. Children really force responsibility. You become the servant of that kid. Oh, my God. You know, you don't have your own life anymore. You can't just go where you want, when you want, do what you want, eat what you want. Your life is structured around somebody else. And that's very civilizing for most people. You know, that's not going to cure anybody of selfishness. Only bhakti cures people of selfishness. But it makes people civilized. And therefore, in every human society, until very recent times, pretty much everybody got married at a young age. The concept of, you know, I was just talking to one devotee. He says, my oldest son is 25. I said, why isn't he married? He said, oh, he's only 25. Prabhupada says there should be compulsory marriage by age 24. So this idea of going on and on and on and on and on in life without marriage is a very new concept in human society. It's certainly not a Varnashram concept. So the men keep the women from being grossly selfish, and the women keep the men from being irresponsible and irreligious. I mean, it's a very, very mutual thing. Because each of us have some tendency that needs to be balanced. And Prabhupada, there's one letter where Prabhupada says how this male and female is created by Krishna, and it has a purpose and exists even in the spiritual world. So what we see is that the male and female energies balance each other. Am I speaking something that's obvious, or is this like really outrageous? The male and female energies balance each other, and the only people who can stay only with the same gender have to be people who are very internally balanced. I mean, this is real. I don't know if I should even have this recorded. Maybe I should not have this listed. I'm going to say recorded on my tape. But this is, it's true even in Vaikuntha. So we have, and I think if we put Krishna at the center, then we can see what do people have to offer each other? Instead of looking at each other as, what problem are you creating for me? Is what do we have to offer? And I was recently invited to a meeting where I was the only woman. And I asked the main person who organized it, why was I invited? And he said, well, I wanted to have a woman. And at first I was offended. And I thought, oh, you wanted just a token woman to say that. And then I thought, well, maybe I bring something to the table. And at a certain point in the meetings, I actually stopped everybody. And I said, I was invited to this meeting. I mean, I was also invited because I'm a scholar. Was the other reason I was invited. But I said I was invited to this meeting for a very particular reason, because I'm bringing something here that nobody else has to bring. And so I'd like to do that right now. And so what I did was I engaged in an empathy exercise in the meeting, and it was interesting that one of the devotees afterwards said, how did you do that? How did you do that? How did you know what my life is like? How did you know what I was thinking? How did you know how I'm feeling? So we have, each of us have something to bring to the table. And although Prabhupada says overall the male body is more suitable for self-realization than is the female body has some things in particular. What are the two things that Srila Prabhupada says the female psychology has as a spiritual advantage? One of them is evident here. What's favorable? There's two things Prabhupada mentions about the female psychology.
They know how to serve for
themselves. They tend to follow authority. That women tend to follow authority because, again, biologically women need protection as the bearer of the children. So there's a tendency for women to follow. And isn't that what's saving Diti here? What's saving her, and what's going to bring her, we're going to see this afternoon, what's going to bring her to Krishna consciousness is, as you see at the end of this section, she says, yes, sir, I will do what you say. She trusts. Men are much less likely to do that kind of thing. One of the reasons why men get this heavy brahmachari training in Vedic civilization is to train them to follow. And one of the main reasons women don't need that is women already follow it. they don't need this heavy training and discipline in college. It's just natural. I mean, unless you train it out of them. Unless you systematically train it out of them. So this, it's a huge, huge benefit if a woman follows the right person. So if a woman has the right person to follow, for her, submission and surrender come very naturally. And what's the other advantage? Which is the opposite of what Kasyapa talks about here.
Maternal way that they can serve others.
Well, you're close to it.
Soft-heartedness.
So, what does it mean to be soft-hearted? See, this relates to what you were talking about in terms of intelligence for the triple. So, that women tend to be more guided by their emotions. So, materially, this is a problem. But spiritually, in bhakti, this is the whole thing. It's the whole thing. Is to be guided by our emotions toward Krishna. So for women to turn their emotions toward Krishna and have that guide everything that they're doing is very easy. So of course, here Kasyapa says that his wife's heart is like a razor blade. But Prabhupada talks about that naturally women are very soft-hearted. So again, being soft-hearted materially is kind of like being sentimental. But in bhakti, it's a huge advantage. So these are the advantages that women have, although overall men have an advantage. Now, Prabhupada makes a point here on a higher level in text 42. So we can talk about using the advantages of our body and mind in bhakti, which is what I've just been talking about. And like I say to people all the time, figure out what kind of vehicle you have. Do you have a bicycle? Do you have a skateboard? Do you have a boat? Do you have a plane? Do you have a car? Do you have an airplane? And then take it back to God. Don't envy, you know, I only have a bicycle and you have an airplane. Just each of us has certain individual advantages and disadvantages. So we're talking about take the female psychology, use it in Krishna service. Take the male psychology, use it in Krishna service. Realize that we balance each other in a society, that there's things that men, that are very important for men to bring to the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and they're very important things for women to bring as well. But here Prabhupada's talking about something completely different. When either a man or a woman is advanced in spiritual consciousness, the bodily conception of life practically vanishes. We should see all women as spiritual units, aham brahmasmi, whose only duty is to satisfy Krishna. Then the influences of the different modes of material nature which result from one's possessing a material body will not act. So this is on another level. This is on the level that when we transcend the body, yes, we still have a body and we still have to use the body in service, but then our relationships become completely different. And I must say, I have been in situations in the Hare Krishna movement, maybe not 100%, but pretty close, where devotees are just working as souls, and people just aren't really thinking. I mean, there's some superficial etiquette and practical arrangements. But other than that, the people are working as everyone's working as a soul, and everyone's working as a servant, and it's just not there. It just kind of vanishes. It's beautiful when that happens. And of course, ultimately, that's the only ultimate way, though the other has to be done as well. So yeah, these are the two things. That the way that women, we're talking about women, but it's true for men too, we have a social system that protects us, and we have ultimately a spiritual system that protects us. The social system is not enough. So there is a social system of the ashram, dharma, brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas, of women being protected, of most men and women being married, of balancing the energies. That's all there, and it's important. It's not that it's not important. But ultimately, the only way we're protected against our gross selfishness and the only way we surrender is we've got to come to the spiritual platform and while it's important that we discuss social considerations, and Srila Prabhupada himself does, and the Bhagavatam itself does, if we only do that and we don't discuss the spiritual, then we're not a transcendent movement anymore. Then we fall into the trap that most religions fall into in time, where we just become about material piety. Okay, Kasyapa Muni now. So he's analyzing this. He said, okay, I'm looking at the male and female psychology. So she's going to use her feminine nature, her beauty, to try to manipulate me. And I fell into the trap of thinking, oh yes, I am such a hero. This woman loves me. I'm going to be a hero and give her whatever she wants. I can give her something that unchaste women cannot get. I am so powerful. And he realizes, I fell into this trap. She fell into a trap, I fell into a trap. Now we're in a trap, now what are we going to do? So he's in a quandary, he's in a moral dilemma. And this is, how does he keep his promise and at the same time not kill his own son? You can see why Kasyapa is really upset with this. Not only does she want to kill somebody, not only does she want to kill Indra, but Indra is his son. Right? By the way, in modern society where polygamy is in a vast minority in the world, it certainly goes on, but it's in a minority, this kind of thing happens with divorce and remarriage, which is our modern version of polygamy, where you have the stepmother and stepfather and things like that. And you will have a stepmother making intrigue against a stepson. Yeah? Stepfather making intrigue against a stepdaughter. This kind of thing goes on. It's not that it doesn't go on in our modern society. It definitely does. It just, you know, instead of Suruchi and Suniti being co-wives, you have one of them as the ex-wife. Yeah? But it's so, my stepmother did this to me. My stepmother convinced my father to disinherit me and my sisters and our children. So very much like what Suruchi did. So this tendency to do this is, it's not that it's just something in the Bhagavatam, it's something that goes on as well. Therefore, Prabhupada says that if someone remarries, they become the enemy to their children. Because the new husband, the new wife, they're going to see them as a threat. So here Diti sees the children of her husband with another woman as a threat. So this was a very painful situation for Kasyapa. Again, think about who Kasyapa is. He's the mother of, and the father-mother of Amandev. You know, he's a very exalted deity. And how painful this situation must be. Do we sometimes get ourselves into things like that where we say yes to something and then afterwards we're like, oh boy, what did I agree to? You know, where some other devotee comes along and flatters us and, oh, you're so capable, you're so qualified, you're so intelligent, you have so much experience, blah, 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 blah. And this is really needed, this service is so much needed, and this has to be done, and this has to be done. And we go, yeah. You know, and then we agree to something, and after we agree to it, we're like, oh my God, I just violated my religious principles by agreeing to this. I just violated my nature, I violated the other things that I have to do. Yeah, this is happening. What do I do? So this is Kasyapa's dilemma. So he comes up with a solution. And here he becomes angry. We had Diti was angry, right? Now he's angry. He's angry at himself. It's interesting he's not angry with Diti. He's not blaming her. He's angry with himself. So now we have this verse 45. Putraste bhavita badre indra padeva bandhava samvatsaram vratam idam yad anjo Darya Yishyasi. So let's look at the word for word. So he said, a son, your Bhavita, will be Bhadre or gentlewoman. He's dealing with her sweetly. Okay, he's not, he condemns himself, he does not condemn her. We can talk about this quite a bit, but anyway, he does not condemn. He deals with her very kindly and very gently. Indraha, killer of Indra or follower of Indra. Well, look at that. Sanskrit is a very cool language.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's cool. You can say something that has two opposite meanings very easily in Sanskrit. Now, there's words like that in English, like the word moot, M-O-O-T, means both relevant and irrelevant. So we have some words in English. If I say, that's moot, it has two opposite meanings. So we have some words in English, and I'm sure in every language, that can be taken in two different ways. But Sanskrit is really good at this kind of thing. So if you want to say something that has two opposite meanings, and you can claim you said one thing, but actually it could mean something else, use Sanskrit. Indraha Adeva Bandhava. So Adeva Bandhava could mean friend of the demons or friend of the demigods. So he said, you're going to have a son who is Indraha and Adeva Bandhava. Now, he does not say in the Sanskrit what Prabhupada says in the translation. He doesn't say, if you follow the vow, you'll get a son who can kill Indra, and if you deviate from the vow, you'll get a son who'll be friends to Indra. He doesn't say that. He says, if you follow the vow, you will get Indraha Adeva Bandhava. But what he's thinking is, it can go either way. That's what he's thinking. Yes? So, this is very clever. So, his first way of dealing with his quandary is to use ambivalent language, equivocal, ambivalent language. Sometimes that's a very good strategy. To use language where you're saying something, but you're not really saying it. Because these people are very truthful. He promised her benediction, and whatever he says has to be true. So he says something where he's telling the truth and giving her what she wants, but he's also saying it so that it can be the opposite of what she wants. So he's covering himself. He's a great Brahmana, you know. He's one of the chief Brahmanas in the universe. He's a great celestial being. That's the first thing. So, the next thing he does is he gives her a process that will purify her of her desire. You want to get this? Do this. But doing this means she won't want to get this anymore. And that's what bhakti is all about. Okay. So his solution was, follow this, and by the time you follow it, the following it will take away your desire. So what was his two ways of coming up with a solution here? The two things that he did. One was the use of words. One was his use of language.
Equivocal
language. One way he did it was with equivocal language. And the other way he did it was? A process that would take away the desire. What do you think would have happened if he had just said, this is a terrible thing to ask? That's what Dasarath did. Did that work?
No.
That's what Dasarath did with Kaikeyi. He said, what a terrible thing you're asking me for. Give it up. Let it go. Did it work? Did she give it up?
No, she was really strong.
What was her response?
You promised.
She got even what? More determined. Sometimes fighting against somebody makes it worse, yeah? You could say, yeah, okay, sure, you can have what you want. Do it this way. This is what Krishna does to all of us. It says that Krishna fulfills the desires of the devotees in a way that they will no longer have that desire. And he does that in many ways. Sometimes he gives you your desire in perfection. You get the palace, you get the kingdom, you get the billions of dollars, you get the whatever you wanted, and then you go like, eh, been there, seen that, done that, don't want it anymore. And other times he gives you the desire in a way that's just awful. You get a desire and it makes you nauseated and you're like, ugh. So sometimes he gives you the desire in a way that makes you satiated. You just, I've had enough, I don't need it anymore. And sometimes he gives you a desire in a way that makes you nauseated. Sometimes he fulfills a desire by you seeing somebody else be in that situation. I've had that happen to me, where Krishna showed me somebody else who got what I thought I wanted. And you look at it and go, I actually don't want that. Yeah? There's somebody who has what I think I want, and ooh, that's not very nice. They're not very happy. I don't want to do that. So what is the only process that absolutely purifies our selfish desires? Bhakti. So he gave her bhakti. Huh? He gave her bhakti. All right. Now, especially as I'm putting some of you to sleep, I'm going to have you do something. Okay. This time I'm just going to give you a choice. You can do it by yourself, those of you who like to work by yourself, or you can do it with somebody else if you want to work with somebody else, whatever you like. I'd like you to make a list of what is in these categories. By the way, I wasn't going to have you do it that way, but there's like three of you that have fallen asleep. So, therefore, I'm going to do it this way. I was just making my teaching method transparent. Any of you that teach, if you see people falling asleep, have to do something active. Okay, some of these are about the mind. Some of these are in general about the body. Some of them are about lying down and sleeping, specifically. He's got a big category about that. And then some of them are about worship. Don't write sentences. Please just write like 1 to 3 words. Don't write whole sentences. But if you can just find these categories and what's the vow under each of these categories. You can do it yourself. You can do it with another person. You can do it with 3 other people. I don't care. But if go through the list, we're looking at verses 47. Through 52-53. So we're looking at 6 verses. Again, just make a list. It should be just like one word, no more than 3. Just a list of what's in those different categories. Huh? He's talking to DT. Why doesn't he tell DT this?
She wouldn't follow him.
So So the only thing that she hears is, oh, I'm going to get what I want. Is the Bhagavatam full of all kinds of benedictions like this? So Jiva Goswami says, this is like you tell your child, if you take this medicine, I'll give you some candy. Right? Same thing. So even the Bhagavatam that throws out all Kaitava Dharma, it gives benedictions, you know, you'll conquer your enemies, right? You'll live a long time. I want that. Yeah, I'll do that, sure. Do this and you'll get love of God. Well, that's not so interesting. You know? You'll live a long life, you'll conquer your enemies. Oh yeah, that was what I wanted to do today. So that's, yes? Please believe me that if I advertise seminars, how to have pure, selfless love of God, I wouldn't get very many people coming. Even in the Hare Krishna movement. I get a lot more people coming if I have advertised a seminar, how to have a happy marriage. Or how to have good health. Or how to be a leader in 9 ways. People are going to be much more interested in that. Even in the Hare Krishna movement. And please, please believe me. Please believe me. I very, very, very rarely get people asking me, how can I fall in love more with Krishna? It happens. But it's rare. It's not the kind of questions I usually get asked. It's not the main interest of people. Just is what it is, what it is. It's some exception. So we have this thing. So, 2 questions. First of all, where else in the Bhagavatam do we have somebody who comes up with a really novel solution to a moral dilemma? To do this and do this, to do opposite things. I'm thinking of 2, but I'm sure there's more. You got to do this, but you don't want to do this.
First one is when Krishna said to Arjuna, kill us with
God. Yes, that's the main one. There's a class I gave on that verse that... It's on my website. The transcription of that class is on my website. And I call it Reality is a Dance, Not a Bureaucracy. Reality is a Dance, Not a Bureaucracy, something like that. It's on my blog. What is Dharma? How do you please Krishna? How do you kill Aswatthama without killing him? There wasn't a rule book. You know, it's not that you pull out a rule book. Killing Brahmanas without killing them, what do I do? Let me look at rule number 537.8.2.7. It required some insight into what Krishna wanted and into the psychology of Aswatthama, the psychology of Draupadi and Bhima and so forth.
Excuse me, what example did you give?
The Aswatthama. Where... Aswatthama is brought and Krishna, and originally Draupadi wanted him killed, and then when Aswatthama came, Krishna said, Draupadi said, I don't kill him. She said, if you kill him, his mother will be crying like I'm crying. Interesting, there Prabhupada also talks about the soft-heartedness of women, the lack of discretion of women. But Krishna agreed with Draupadi, actually. And then Bhima was saying, kill him. And Krishna said, you have to satisfy Bhima, Draupadi, and me. And Krishna did not tell Arjuna what to do. He said, here's a problem. Solve it. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating section. But other thing I was thinking of is Krishna picking up a wheel that's a weapon and not a weapon. Well, I didn't pick up a weapon. It was a chariot wheel. It wasn't a weapon. do something and not do it at the same time. So, yeah, I don't know if anybody, those are the two I can think of. Is there any other examples you can think of?
When Akrura wanted to take Krishna to Mathura, then when he went into the river, then Krishna was around. Vasudeva Krishna and Krishna, they are separate.
Oh, they're kind of there and not there? Well, that's a kind of funny thing with Krishna, who never leaves Vrindavan, but he leaves Vrindavan. I was just reading that in Krishna Bhava. How did Krishna leave Vrindavan when he never leaves Vrindavan? So he stays in his bhava expansion, but he leaves, so he's there. He's there, he's not there. I don't think if there's any other examples of doing and not doing simultaneously. I'm sure there are others, I just can't think of them. The other thing I want to ask is that look at this list of mental things. No envy, no harm, no cursing, no anger. Doesn't that mean she has to automatically give up the mentality that she had in the first place? Yeah, remember she was like feeding this anger and grief? And her husband said, nope, no more. Now what happens when you stop feeding your anger? Yeah, it goes away. When you stop feeding anger, it goes away. It goes to someone else's house for food. It stops hanging around your house. And if you're not feeding your anger at somebody, do you still want to kill them? Not usually. Right? So that right there we have something. How is it that bhakti changes one's desires? This is what I want to end with. Yeah?
It changes one's understanding of one's identity.
Changes our identity. Understanding of our identity.
And we have different desires.
Yes, desires all come from identity. If I'm a spiritual being and I'm a servant of God, what do I care about this stuff? That was Chitraketu's mentality, right? Once he was engaged in bhakti by Narada, then he didn't care anymore. It was irrelevant. So when one identifies as a servant of Krishna, as a spirit soul, it just doesn't matter. That somebody killed my children. It's not relevant. Any other way that bhakti changes our mentality, changes our desires?
It's like bhakti gives us the real knowledge, and we can understand that what we wanted is like a very silly thing, which we don't use.
Ah, very nice. So bhakti gives us knowledge of what's real, and then in comparison our desires appear silly and childish. Yes? Yes. You get a higher taste. You get a higher pleasure. Basically, Prabhupada says that bhakti removes our material desires because all those desires become fulfilled in bhakti. So a very simple example. So most of us, I assume, would like money. If somebody came and gave us some money, we would probably accept it. Why do we generally want money? What does money give us? An opportunity to get things. Why do we want things? What do the things give us?
Freedom.
Money gives you freedom. Definitely money gives you freedom. And then you can go places, you can do things, you can eat what you want, you know, you can buy the food you want, you can buy the clothes you want, you can go where you want. So it gives you freedom. What else does money give you?
We don't exchange.
Yeah, but what does it give you?
Independence.
Same thing.
Joy.
It can give you joy. It can bring you good food, nice clothing, nice furniture. It can bring you some sense of pleasure and happiness. What else can money give you?
Status, power.
Status and power. Yes. Oh, definitely. even in the society of devotees. Some rich person comes in, we're all going to flatter them and give them what they want. Yes? We will. So it gives you status and power. Yes, what else?
Security.
Security. In fact, that's even the name for it. When you buy stocks and bonds, they're called securities. So if you have money, you feel, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be able to have a place to live. I'm going to be able to have food to eat. I'm going to have, you know, people will like me. I'll be secure. I can pay for a doctor. So it gives us security. And what were you going to say?
Resources to preach.
Resources to preach. Very nice. So let's say you have that. Let's say we had full and complete freedom, full and complete pleasure, full and complete power, full and complete security, and full and complete resources to preach. Would we care about money? No.
It's just a means.
It's just a means. So if we're in touch with Krishna and all of our desires are fulfilled, we no longer look for material means of fulfilling those desires because they're already fulfilled. Well, that's the main way the bhakti changes are. The main ways we talked about the bhakti changes our desires. Oh, one other thing, which I just realized now, and I hadn't realized when I was preparing it. In fact, it was confusing me. It seemed to me that that Kasyapa was giving Diti a very ritualistic process. And it kind of bothered me. I was thinking, why are these rituals? How is it bhakti? It seemed much more of a karma kanda or karma yoga kind of thing than a bhakti yoga thing. And it was bothering me. But I think I understand it. I don't know. Tell me what you think of this new insight I had just in the last minute. Diti is the mother of the demons. She's the mother of people who are against Vishnu. Her sister's the mother of the Vaishnavas and the Lord. And her whole thing is to be against Indra, who gets Vishnu to kill her sons. So I'm wondering if Kasyapa is disguising what he's doing a little bit. Because the real essence of what he's giving her that's changing her is the worship part. And even the worship part, he's mixing. He's saying, worship the Lord and Lakshmi and also the cows and the brahmanas and pious women. Right? It seems to me that he's kind of sticking it in there without it being obvious. That maybe, this is just my rampant philosophical speculation, but you know, that maybe if he just said, okay, worship Vishnu, she'd go, worship Vishnu, he's the one who killed my sons at the instigation of Indra, don't worship Vishnu. But he makes it seem like it's this ritualistic thing, this is my guess. Sleep this way, eat this thing, have this mentality, don't talk to these kind of people, don't eat this kind of food. And here's a whole list of your worship. Worship the brahmanas and worship these women and worship the Lord with Lakshmi and, you know, all this. It's a package. And bhakti's kind of just stuck in there in the package. And the way she's probably looking at it, if this is some mechanical ritual. Oh, this is a mechanical ritual by my husband's great power. That's going to give me this son that will kill Indra. And actually what he's doing is, what do you think? Does that sound like it might be the case? Yeah, I hadn't thought, because it was really bothering me. I'm just like, how exactly is this bhakti? How is it pure bhakti? By the way, do we do that in our preaching?
Yes. Preach.
Yes?
I would have a question regarding one of the vows.
Yes, sure.
Never enter the water by bathing.
I understand that as meaning that, like, you bathe in a shower rather than a bath. So instead of going into the river to bathe, you take a bucket out of the river and pour it over your body.
Like enjoying the
I have no idea. I have no idea what the purpose of some of these are. Yeah, well, that would be cleaner. If you don't enter the water that you're bathing in, it'd be cleaner. Of course, if you go into a river, it wouldn't make any difference. But into a bath or a tank, then you're sitting in the dirty water. But some of them, like not cutting your nails, has always confused me. There's other places in the Bhagavatam where it talks about, like, the vanaprastas not cutting their nails. So being a vanaprasta, I guess I should have, like, these curlicues at the end of my fingers. But Prabhupada wrote in one letter that if you want to attain to bhava, you should be very clean and keep your nails very short. He did. He wrote that as something in relationship to attaining to bhava. Yeah?
I was wondering if some of these things are just practical things that actually apply generally. Like, for instance, well, I don't know how practical it is, but one thing is not to sleep with your head pointing west or north.
Right.
And some of you always follow that.
I always follow that.
But maybe that's just helping us to accept it.
It's interesting, you know, he's putting a lot of stuff in there. Some of it, I don't get it at all. Some of it, I'm just like, why aren't you going to cut your nails? Some of it, yeah, maybe it's just general. I mean, with the directions you sleep in certainly affects your body's, you know, the magnetic energies in your body's. In your body. So it might have something to do with sattva guna. Might have something to do with modes, I don't know. But I'm really wondering if a lot of these things are there just as kind of fluff. Just that that's what she's looking for. She's looking for something ritualistic. So he's giving her what she wants. That's my guess. There's no commentary on this, so I just don't know. And then the mental stuff is obvious. First of all, he wants her to do bhakti in sattva guna, he doesn't want her to do bhakti in rajaguna and tamo guna. And also the mental stuff is exactly opposite to what her problem that she's coming in with. Okay, any other questions or thoughts on this? Yes?
Not on this, but before, you said that how we apply it into this consciousness of man or woman. But in this lifetime, identify with your packaging. But what if the soul is going into another kind of condition? Would this previous impressions work on it? Say, suppose I'm identifying I'm a woman, and then I leave the body, and then I become, say, man.
Uh-huh.
So now I'm so wired that I am a woman. So will this affect me in the next context?
Well, first of all, we could assume that all of us have been both genders. That's it. That's a very safe assumption. It would be extremely unusual if any of us had been only taking birth as men or only taking birth as women. I think we can basically assume that we've had some lifetimes as each. And according to astrology, it's practically unheard of that somebody has a totally female or a totally male psychology. In fact, astrologers will say that the ideal mix is 60-40 or 70-30 in favor of your physiological gender. They'll say that if you're a physical woman and you're 90% female by astrology, you're out of balance. So that the ideal mix is slightly more than majority rather than super heavy on one side or another. And even the hormones that determine our gender, everybody has both male and female hormones. It's the balance of it. Are we affected from one life to the other? Probably to some extent. And I'm sure that's the problem sometimes with people who are confused. I'm sure there's many reasons for people's gender confusion. Probably some of it is the chemicals that are in our current water supply. So there's a lot of sex hormones in our water supply. And I'm sure that is contributing to the gender confusion. But some of it, yeah. I mean, if somebody was a woman for 10 lifetimes and then they become a man, it's probably a little harder, or vice versa. But most of us switch around. You know, you get attached to a woman, you become a woman, you get attached to a man, you become a man. Or you just have that desire, you know, someone's walking around, and like, I wish I was a man, I wish I was a man, I wish I was a man, become a man. Okay, check it out, try it out. See if it works any better for you. You know, my view is like, no thanks. I'll take the Maya I have, thank you very much. I don't really need the other kind. I've done that, been there, seen that, done that. I'm still in the material world, you know. I've just fallen in love with Krishna. But yeah, it's pretty typical. I know one devotee couple, he's passed away, but I know a devotee couple that several different astrologers told them that they'd been married for 16 lifetimes, but switching off who was the man and who was the woman. I'm sure that's also very common. Sure, that that's a very common thing. And you know, with our family members switching around, that you know, the daughter in one life was the mother in the other life, or the sister in another life, or the brother in another life. That's extremely common. That we take birth again, we get drawn to the same set of jivas, but that we take different roles. One of my grandsons, when he was 6, he looked at my son and said, "Why do you always have to be in charge?" You know. So the son who's thinking, "I wish I was the father." You know. And I can't. Does it affect us to some extent? Sure. We on some subconscious level, we remember our unfulfilled desires from previous lives. That Krishna reminds us, you wanted this, you wanted this, you wanted this. Some of the mentality carries over. Sometimes that's true with nationality. You know, I know people, they're born in one country, but they end up moving to another country and spending their whole life in the other country and identifying with the culture of that other country. You're like, they probably live there in another life. And they're just, you know, the way I look at this is whatever I am in now is ultimately due not just to my karma, but to the will of the Supreme. And therefore, it's best to work with what I have now. Also, keep in mind that we're never going to feel that what we have fully fits, because it doesn't matter what it is, it's not me. So it doesn't matter if we're talking about male or female. There's also people who are neither male or female, by the way. It's rare, but there are such persons. Whether we're thinking, you know, in terms of gender, in terms of nationality, in terms of whatever. It's not me. I'm not this body, I'm not this mind. I'm never going to feel completely comfortable with it. I'm never going to feel, yes, this is me, because it's not. So, you know, whether you're a spiritualist or a materialist doesn't really matter. You're never going to feel fully that your material identity is who you are, because it's not. There's always going to be aspects of it that are uncomfortable and that are, you know, gosh, I don't really, this doesn't work right now. Whether that's because of past lives or whether it's because we're souls. It doesn't really matter. So whatever it is, take it, tolerate the fact that there's some discomfort about it and use it to go back to Godhead and don't worry about it. That's my philosophy. Like, just don't worry about it. You got this body, that mentality. Who cares? What does it matter? It lasts 8 billionths of a second for Lord Brahma. Use it in Krishna's service. Go back to Godhead. Like, don't get hung up on it. It's like, oh, I wish I could change this thing. I wish I could change this thing. I don't feel comfortable with this thing. I don't feel, you're really stupid. Then you just get another body after another body and check it out. Is that okay? We're done with that section. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srila Bhagavatam ki jai.